taking their place in a long true line of everyday Americans.
Helping to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. This is the Constitution Study on the America Out Loud Network with your host, Paul Engel.
Pay the bills, stay out of jail, love the neighbors and have a few good friends. Every day you were every day American.
Well, hello there, everyday Americans, and welcome to the Constitution Study. You know, part of reading and studying the Constitution means getting through the myths, the fallacies, and getting to the heart of what the Constitution actually says. Today, I want to spend some time on a series of articles I've found and some discussion about the idea of both religious freedom and conscience freedom. The fact that there's actually quite a bit of discrimination in this country based on people's religious belief or simply on their conscience. So let me start with one of the most common misunderstandings, mistakes that's made when it comes to religious freedom. Your religious freedom is not protected solely by the First Amendment to the Constitution. Your religious liberty is not protected solely by the First Amendment to the Constitution. If you followed me for any length of time, you've seen the number of court cases that I've reviewed where whether it's a freedom of speech or freedom of religion or freedom of the press, it's automatically treated as a federal issue because of the First Amendment. But the First Amendment starts out with five very important words. Congress shall make no law. Meaning, unless it's the action is based on a law from Congress, it can't be a First Amendment issue. Now, before you start wondering, well, where do we get freedom? All of those freedoms are protected in our state constitutions. Each and every state has a version of the language that protects your freedom of religion, your freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom to peaceably assemble, and to petition your government for redress of grievance. They're there. Now, the reason they're separate is, well, the idea of a state religion based on the individual state as opposed to a federal religion was not anathema. It was not considered beyond the pale. We had state religions. Religions that were not only predominant in a state, but in many cases were funded by the state. Now, that's pretty much gone. But the idea that you have the right to not only believe what you want, but to express it, to exercise it, is important. It is one of the fundamental freedoms of being an American, of living in America, of just being here. Now, there are some points I want to make. Freedom of religion is often referred to as our first freedom because it's the first freedom protected in the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights. However, it was not the first freedom proposed to be protected. In fact, there were 12 amendments proposed for the Bill of Rights. It was only 3 through 12 that were actually ever adopted. Now, the first proposed amendment had to do with the number of representatives in the House. That has never been adopted. The second had to do with pay raises. No law varying the compensation for the services of senators and representatives shall take effect until an election of representatives shall have intervened. In other words, you couldn't vote yourself a pay raise without having to go through one of the two-year election cycles. Now, interesting enough, that was eventually ratified in 1992. So it was actually the third proposed amendment that became the First Amendment that starts out, Congress shall make no law establishing a religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So freedom of religion consists of two parts. And not only the fact that we have two parts, but what those two parts are very important to understand. Now, again, Congress shall make no law. So we're talking about federal restrictions on the exercise and establishment of religion. So again, the first, the Establishment Clause. Congress shall make no law establishing a religion. Well, the first question we should ask is, what does it mean to establish a religion? Does it mean I go out in the front yard and say, I now declare myself the First Church of Paul? No. According to Noah Webster, to establish means to enact or decree by authority for permanence, to settle permanently or to erect or settle something that cannot be changed. So it is not as many states and many courts have adopted the idea of simply acknowledging a religion. That is not establishing a religion. Simply allowing a religion in public place doesn't establish it, doesn't make it permanent. It certainly doesn't enact it by decree. See, that would be a violation of the Free Exercise Clause, which says that your right to federal government cannot prohibit the free exercise of your religion. Now, like everything else, the boundaries of any right end when it infringes on the right of another. So for those who like to take the straw man approach, you know, well, what about human sacrifice? There are religions that support human sacrifice. Yeah, and that would infringe on the rights of others. So, understand that for you to legitimately exercise any right, you cannot infringe on the rights of another. So you know, that's a straw man that often gets set aside. But today, I'm focusing on how our freedom of religion, and I want to talk about our freedom of conscience as well. Because if you look at the First Amendment, look at what's being protected here. Your ability to exercise your religion, to speak as you wish, to print, to publish as you wish, to assemble with others who you agree with as you wish, and to petition the government for a redress of a grievance against you. All of these deal with acts of conscience. The idea that your conscience tells you how you wish to exercise your religion. Your conscience informs your speech and what you print or publish. Your conscience informs who you gather with, which movements you would support and which you wouldn't. Even the ability to determine what grievances you're going to petition the government for, these are all acts of conscience. The freedom of the mind, and by extension, the freedom of the body to act out what the mind perceives is true. The First Amendment is protecting not simply those five freedoms. It's the general idea of protecting our freedom of conscience. So that's why I refer to the episode date as religious and conscience discrimination. See, sometimes it's not just attacks upon our religion, whatever that religion may be. Sometimes it's literally attacks on our conscience. And since there's been so much of this revolving around mass mandates and vaccine passports and all of that, it kind of brought to mind the attacks on our conscience, the discrimination on our conscience. But it also means there's been other stories about religious freedom and conscience freedom that have kind of, well, they've sailed under the radar. They didn't get the attention because everyone's been focusing on the other things that are going around. So I want to spend a little time with those today. And the first one I'm going to talk about is Florida State University. See, Florida State University was sued by a gentleman by the name of Jack Denton. He was the president of the Student Senate. And according to the stories I've read, Mr. Denton, while president of the Student Senate, shared some of his religious beliefs. He's a Roman Catholic. Now, he shared those beliefs, those personal beliefs, with other Catholic students in a private text conversation. Now, for whatever reason, screenshots of that conversation were then shared on social media, which led to him being removed from his leadership position. Now, the Alliance Defending Freedom defended him, and now Florida State University has finally agreed to settle the lawsuit out of court. Basically, what the university has agreed, they've agreed to pay him some amount of damages to update their records that improperly reflected his unconstitutional removal. In other words, they're going to purge the removal, his removal from office from their records, and they're going to issue a statement assuring and ensuring that students have equal access to student government positions irrespective of their religion or religious beliefs. Now, this to me is, one, I'm happy this came about. Now, this didn't get decided by a court, but it is to me, it's a good outcome. Right? One, again, you have the petitioning of a government for a redress of grievance. The student believed that a public university, Florida State University, unlawfully removed him from office because of his religious beliefs, because he expressed it, he exercised his religion in a text message, and the school agreed. I don't know what they're paying for damages. I'm hoping ADF gets their legal fees back. Alliance Defending Freedom does a lot of work pro bono. So they are defending the rights of Americans. I hope they're getting their legal fees paid. But to me, the two important things here are the student's record is being updated. So it's being expunged, the fact that he was removed from office, so that anybody who goes back to a school transcript doesn't say, hey, why were you removed from office? And he doesn't have to explain himself. That's good. Now, the other thing I like is the school is issuing a statement that, listen, just because you have a religious belief that may conflict with somebody else doesn't mean you're not qualified for a student government position. Now, I'm not going to hold my breath. I'm hoping that the school abides by that. It's important that those who attend or those who are alums of Florida State University make sure the school abides by this agreement. But to me, this is an example of what happens when a person is willing to defend their free exercise of religion, and they're using their right to petition the government for a redress of grievance to do that. So I'm not happy that Mr. Denton had to go through all of this, but the outcome seems fair, the outcome seems just, and the outcome does seem, at least to me, constitutional. I don't know how much the school is paying for their mistake. My only hope is that whatever costs ADF and Mr. Denton went through to get justice is repaid by the school. So there's a situation where we saw an infringement on the state protection of religion. Again, this is a state school, therefore it was not the Congress they were working under. This was the state legislature, so it was a violation of the Florida Constitution. Next, we're going to turn to a situation that's still apparently in progress. A high school student from Michigan, not just any student, a high school valedictorian is being censored by her school, at least according to the reports I'm reading. So the valedictorian of a Michigan school, Elizabeth Turner, she's a valedictorian at Hillsdale High School in Hillsdale, Michigan. So as a valedictorian, she gives a speech at the graduation. Okay. She drafts a speech and then submits it to the school for approval. All right. Time out right there. We're talking a public school. Therefore, it's part of they are exercising the state powers. This is done under the state of Michigan. And Article 1, Section 5 of the Michigan Constitution reads, every person may freely speak, write, express, and publish his views on all subjects, being responsible for the abuse of such right, and no law shall be enacted to restrain or abridge the liberty of speech or of the press. So why does the student have to submit her speech to the school for approval? Isn't that censoring? Isn't that restraining the liberty of speech for this student? Well, she submitted the speech. and it was returned with censored. There were several passages that were censored out of this speech, specifically those mentioning Jesus Christ and her Christian faith. Now, why was this done? Well, apparently, according to the school principal, she believed that discussing Christianity was not appropriate. It would not be representing the school. Well, sorry, Ms. Goldsmith, who's the principal of the school, it's not the state's authority to determine what is or is not appropriate for a valedictorian writing a speech that represents her. Now, if you are giving the speech, Ms. Goldsmith, then yes, there would be restrictions because you are a government actor in a position of authority established by government, not Ms. Turner. This is the twisted view that any mention of religion or any mention of Christianity, let's be a little more pointed in this. I somehow am not sure, but I tend to doubt that if Ms. Turner was, say, a Muslim and referred to Muhammad or Allah, there'd be so much that, you know, she'd have been censored. Or if she was a Hindu and referring to chakras or yoga, would she have been censored? See, this is in some ways actually establishing religion, but it certainly is suppression of the freedom of speech. It is most offensive, and it should be most offensive to any liberty-minded American, that a government official gets to determine what is or is not appropriate for a private citizen to include in her speech. It was not Hillsdale High School that made valedictorian. It was Elizabeth Turner. This was her speech. Goldsmith says, you are representing the school in your speech, not using the podium as a public forum. Wrong, Mrs. Smith. She is not representing the school. She is representing herself and her achievement. The fact that it happens on school property means absolutely nothing. It doesn't mean that she's suddenly representing the school. She is representing her own position, her own beliefs. This is censorship. This is a violation of the Michigan Constitution. This is a violation of free speech, freedom of religion. Now, what's interesting is that Ms. Turner's family has hired a law firm, First Liberty. And again, First Liberty, another liberty-based law firm. They do a lot of good work. But again, we have the same problem. See, according to the firm, Ms. Turner has the right to express her private religious beliefs due to the free speech and free exercise clause of the First Amendment. Well, again, this was not Congress. This is not a federal school. This is a public school, a Michigan school. So it is not a violation of the First Amendment. It is a violation of Article 1, Section 5 of the Michigan Constitution. But Paul, if they say basically the same thing, what's the difference? Well, I have a couple of cases that are in the works where I show how claiming an infringement of the wrong law or the wrong constitution just damages your case. The most public one I've covered recently was when Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton sued because it was a Georgia, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin inappropriately changed. Well, he said that their presidential electors were not appointed properly. The problem is, rather than focusing on the fact that the manner of appointing electors was altered by someone other than the state legislature, which is a violation of the Constitution, Article 2, Section 1. He went into all of this, you know, other things about how they had conducted their election, which Texas has no say in. Texas has no standing to claim to complain about how another state conducts their election, only that they violated the compact that is the Constitution, to which Texas is a party. And in large part, I believe because of that, his lawsuit failed. So my concern is, here we have, and again, Liberty First does a lot of great work. I just think they're wrong. I think by making this a federal case, you do two things. You remove it from its context. This is a Michigan problem. But suddenly we want to take it to federal court. Why? Why does everything have to become a federal case? The other problem you run into is, now, again, you're removing it from not simply the state of Michigan, because it'll be a Michigan appeals court. But now, if it goes to a judge that can actually read the Constitution, he says, Congress shall make no law. Well, Congress didn't make this law. Case closed. Ms. Turner loses. Because the correct judgment in this case, if it's brought on a First Amendment issue, is for the school. The school didn't violate the First Amendment. On the other hand, again, I haven't seen the lawsuit, but on the other hand, if they say, no, they violated Article 1, Section 5 of the Michigan Constitution, there you go. That should be a pretty cut and dried case. It should be an easy case. And it should be dealt with much quicker in a state court than in a federal court. At least the chances of that happening are greater. So there's a lot of it's one of the reasons why I get so worked up, shall we say, is we have someone here with an extremely solid case that may not come to the proper outcome, not because of the actions of the person aggrieved, but because their legal advice is making everything a federal case, and they're going to bring it to the wrong court under the wrong precepts, the wrong understandings, and that's a problem that should bother all of us. So to me, that's one of the reasons why I focus on these things, and I believe the details matter. I believe that these conscience cases that everyone seems to take as a First Amendment issue are actually weakening our position, because they open them up to the criticism, to the correct criticism, that it's not Congress that's making these laws, therefore, how can it be a violation of the First Amendment? But since lawyers don't study the Constitution in law school, at least not according to my informal poll, I ask every lawyer I meet, did they study the Constitution in law school or constitutional law? And all but one so far have said constitutional law, which is the opinion of judges about the Constitution. And in fact, it's the opinion of a judge over the opinion of a judge about the opinion of a judge about the opinion of a judge about what that judge thought about the Constitution. So it's that type of stuff that leads us farther and farther away from what the Constitution actually says. And its simplicity is the beauty of what makes it so powerful. But when we dilute it by throwing everything we can under the First Amendment, we actually weaken the Constitution. We don't strengthen it. And we weaken our cases. We don't strengthen them. Which is why understanding religious and conscience protections and understanding how to defend your rights and to do so properly is so important. It's one of the reasons why I'm doing my road trip this summer, why I'm going around helping people to understand the Constitution. I call it my Knowing Your Rights tour. Right now, I'm going through the Northern Plains. I'm going to be in Missouri. If you want to find out what I'll be talking about, if you want to find out where I'll be when, head to constitutionstudy.com/tour. I have a brief description of my main content. You can see where I'll be stopping. I've got a couple of other things people have asked me to do while I'm on the way. If you would like to attend, there's information about attending, about where, who to contact for the different events. If I'm not going to be in your area, if you would like me to come speak at your event, there's a form at the bottom of that page. Fill it out, and we'll see if we can make it happen. I've been asked, it's interesting, I set up a few of these events, and I've had people coming to me saying, Paul, will you come here? Paul, will you come here? I'm trying very hard to accommodate all of those. It's not always easy based on travel and schedules and whatnot, but I'm trying to meet all of those. Everyone who wants me to come speak to them, I'm doing my best to do that. So please, again, head to the website, constitutionstudy.com/tour. Find out if I'll be in your area. If you can, I would love to meet you. Please tell me that you heard me on the radio program. I'd love to have a moment to talk to you about the program and see what you think. If you can't make it and you'd like me to come to your area, it doesn't have to be a big event. If you look, I'm one of the things I'm doing is a social hour. We're just going to sit around and talk for a while before one of my events. One group in Thermopolis, Wyoming, we're meeting in a bakery. We're just going to get together and chat and talk for a while. You know, I'm going to give my little I'll give my little part of it, but then we're going to sit down and we're going to have questions and answers and talk and fellowship. It's going to be wonderful. So please head over to constitutionstudy.com/tour. Find out more. Invite me to come visit your location. I'm hoping to get up to the Northeast. As many of you know, I used to live in upstate New York. I lived in upstate New York most of my life. I love to get to that area and meet people and talk with them. I'm very excited about this. So please, let's see if we can make it happen. And you know, that's a lot of work. I don't know if you spent time on the road. I spent a good chunk of my IT career, traveling as part of my job, and it really wears you out. You know, you get tired, and we even have a name for it. You call it the crud. You know, you go to a conference, you get the crud. You come home and you've got that, you know, it's a cold, you just feel bad. Well, one of the things you need to do is to make sure your immune system is in good shape. And one of the best ways to do that, you can support your immune system by going with Healthy Cells Gel Packs. These are wonderful little things. I've been taking the Immune Super Boost now for a while. I like it. It's just a little packet. There's no pills. You can either take the gel straight, just give it a shot, or you can mix it in with a drink or with a smoothie. It gives you the vitamins and minerals your body needs so that your cells can remain healthy to boost your immune system, which is not only important when you travel like me, but just dealing with life. So please head over to healthycell.com/outloud and get 20% off your first order for being an America Out Loud listener. And then hang around, and I'll be right back after this short break.
Because of COVID-19, the average American worries about their immune health 4 times a day. That's 112 times per year. To minimize the worries, leading nutritional supplement company, Healthy Cell, created Immune Super Boost, an immune supplement that contains 15 full doses of science-backed nutrients like vitamin C, zinc, elderberry, and echinacea, all in a one-a-day pill-free gel pack. It tastes great, is convenient on the go, and it's more natural too, without chemical binders, fillers, and coatings. Supporting a strong and resilient immune system can be simple. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of Immune Super Boost. That's HealthyCell.com, HealthyCell, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
As we celebrate our 5-year anniversary, America Out Loud has expanded its mission through a newly designed website with a host of new contributors, all carrying a vibrant message of hope and survival for this country we love. AmericaOutLoud.com. Together, we'll secure the future for generations to come.
Welcome back to the Constitution Study. This is where we read and study the Constitution. We teach the rising generation to be free, and sometimes we have to stand for what our conscience tells us to. We must do the hard thing. And it's important that we not do it meanly or vindictively, but that we do it honestly. And sometimes that comes with a cost. For example, a Virginia elementary school gym teacher by the name of Byron Tanner Cross said he could not tell students who are biological boys that they are girls. Now, he spoke to the school board. He said he would not affirm that a biological boy can be a girl and vice versa. And because of that, he's been placed on administrative leave. Now, a couple things I want to point out. Mr. Cross said he could not, in accordance with his religious belief, tell students who are biological boys that they are girls. Now, as an individual, again, he has every right to make that determination. The question that we need to think about, and we need to think fairly about this, is as a employee of the government of Virginia, of Loudoun County, Virginia, he's an employee in that role, can he be forced to violate his conscience? Now, if you've listened to me in the past, you probably understand. First of all, the state is violating its basic duty by allowing boys in the girls' room, and in many cases, girls in the boys' room, although I am much more concerned with boys in the girls' room. Why? Well, I once was a teenage boy. I know what it's like to be flooded with hormones. And the thought, let's face it, when I was a teenage boy, the thought of being able to go into the girls' room or the girls' locker room was enticing. And it had nothing to do with what I felt like, whether I felt I was a boy or a girl. And knowing human beings the way I have, I've been around 57 years, I've met quite a few human beings, I know there are boys that will lie in order to sneak a peek in the girls' room, especially the girls' locker room. So the idea that we're going to endanger our young girls, that the county, that any county in any state would endanger the young girls that are there for the sake of appearing woke, it is a direct violation. You remember, the Declaration of Independence says governments are created to protect our rights. That includes the rights of the young girls. But what about the rights of the young boys? I'm sorry. If they want to walk around in dresses and pretend they're girls, I don't think the government should stop them. But when they violate the rights of the girls, they've gone too far. Now, it's interesting because when he opened his statement before the school board, he said, "My name is Tanner Cross, and I'm speaking out of love for those who suffer with gender dysphoria." And I do as well. I mean, confusion about who you are, looking at your body and thinking it's wrong, that's got to be tough. Now, of course, studies show that many teenagers go through a phase where they're not quite sure about themselves, and you know, their hormones drive them crazy. And we look at, for example, 60 Minutes did an episode where they talked to 30 young people who felt betrayed. They felt they were led astray by their push to transition, and now they're transitioning back. But guess what? They have forever lost something. They've forever lost the ability to have children because the parts they need were mutilated. I feel for them, and I want to do what's best for them. And as Mr. Cross said, "It's not my intention to hurt anyone, but there are certain truths that we must face when ready. We condemn school policies that would damage children, defile the holy image of God. I love all of my students, but I will never lie to them, regardless of the consequences." He says, "I'm a teacher, but I serve God first, and I will not affirm that a biological boy can be a girl and vice versa because it's against my religion. It's lying to a child, it's abuse to a child, and it's sinning against our God." Now, this is a situation, and I believe that if Mr. Cross's job requires him to affirm something he cannot, he should leave the job. I mean, that is true of pretty much anywhere. But I also believe that the Loudoun School District is, again, violating its most basic purpose of government, that is, protecting the rights of the individual. And that means not allowing an individual to infringe on the rights of another. So this is a situation where we've actually got two things that we're dealing with. One is, Mr. Cross, if your job requires you to affirm a lie, then it's your responsibility, as you're trying to do, to change the job. If they won't change, to leave. That's my opinion. Now, I'm not you. I don't know all the situations. I don't know all that. That's my opinion. You're free to do and deal with this how you wish, Mr. Cross. In fact, I wouldn't mind if you want to contact me. I'd love to have this discussion with you on the radio. I'd be more than happy, reach out through the website, constitutionstudy.com, and I'll be more than happy to discuss this with you on the radio, on a radio segment. But as a general rule, if your job is asking you to do something that violates your conscience, then we shouldn't have that job. On the other hand, and by the way, I've had those discussions with my bosses, with things that I would not do because of my conscience. And if that was going to be a requirement, I was prepared to leave. But the other part we have here is the crushing of the conscience. Again, not just of Mr. Cross. Think of those young girls. Imagine your wife, your daughter. Again, this is a school. So imagine your daughter. She's going to school one day. She's in the ladies' room, the girls' room. She's in the girls' locker room. And a guy walks in, takes off his clothes, possibly leering, possibly not. How safe does that girl feel in that situation? See, there's this little thing in the law called reason. And if a reasonable person reasonably perceives a threat to themselves, they're legally able to respond to it. So if your daughter is in the girls' room or the girls' locker room and a boy walks in, or a man for that matter, but a boy walks in, does she have a reasonable belief that things may not be right? That he may not be there for a sound reason? That it may be more than just how he feels that day? Does she have a reasonable, legally reasonable ability to respond to what could be a threat to her? See, in any other situation, in any other situation, until the last few years, a young man walking into the ladies' room, the girls would have had every right to grab him physically and throw him out the door, to perceive him as a threat to their physical well-being. But this nation has become crazy. And because some boys want to think they're girls, ignoring science and reality, either because they're confused or because they're taking advantage of a seriously demented school system, we're willing to ignore the conscience of the young girls. The vast majority of the people in that restroom or in that locker room, and accommodate the delusion of the young boy. Now, it works both ways, right? If a young girl decides she wants to go into the boys' room, I think that's just as wrong. But I don't think she shows this in most cases. In the average case, I don't think she presents the same physical threat to a boy. Simple biology. She's going to tend to be smaller. She's not going to have the muscle mass. She doesn't generally have the aggressive tendencies that young boys do. So while it's just as wrong, I'm more worried about the girls because they are more likely to be the victims of something. And this school district and many others are trashing the conscience of our young girls in order to make certain social justice warriors not yell at them so much. And as far as I'm concerned, that's just cowardly. I mean, they might as well put on a lion suit and play in The Wizard of Oz. Next, how many of you have heard about Blaine Amendments? See, a Blaine Amendment is an amendment in the majority of the states that bar the state from using state funds for any, giving state funds to any religious organization. In fact, the proposed text was, no state shall make any law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, and no money raised by taxation in any state for the support of public schools or derived from any public funds therefore, nor any public lands devoted thereto, shall ever be under the control of any religious sect, nor shall any money so raised or land so devoted be divided between religious sects or denominations. It's interesting because he's basically taking the freedom of religion from the First Amendment, he's applying it to the states, but he's adding these restrictions that say no state money can be used for religious purposes. Now, this amendment failed. It actually passed in the House, but it died in the Senate. But what happened is a bunch of states put them in their own state constitutions, which is where it brings me to a Daily Signal article coming out of South Carolina. See, the South Carolina Supreme Court barred the governor from distributing any of the relief funds that he had received from the federal coronavirus for private and religious schools. In other words, he can spend it whatever he wants, but not private schools and not religious schools. And, well, let's say private religious schools and colleges, well, they've sued. They've filed an action in federal court challenging the court's ruling. Now, the court cited the Blaine Amendment to the state's constitution as reason for doing this. They said, we are barred by the Constitution of the state of South Carolina from distributing funds to religious organizations. Now, the suit claims that the Blaine Amendment violates both the Free Exercise and the Equal Protection Clauses of the U.S. Constitution. Well, we've already dealt with free exercise, right? This is not Congress making a law. This is a state constitution. Therefore, it cannot be a violation of the U.S. First Amendment. In fact, South Carolina Constitution, Article 1, Section 2, says the General Assembly shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and petition a government for redress, a petition of government or any department thereof for a redress of grievance. So we see a parallel between the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and Article 1, Section 2 of the South Carolina Constitution. But since the Blaine Amendment came out of the General Assembly, there's a tightrope to walk, right? Because did the General Assembly make a law? No, they proposed a constitutional amendment for the Blaine Amendment. So the First Amendment issue is really should be dead, right? But it's interesting. They also quote the Equal Protection Clause, which is Amendment 14, Section 1, which says that no state shall deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. And this, to me, is a more interesting question. So now what we have is we have a law that says that the state of South Carolina has passed to take the $48 million they've received from the CARES Act to distribute to education institutions, but we're going to segregate. We're not going to treat them all equally. That's why I find it interesting, is private and religious. So it's not simply a Blaine Amendment issue, but it's an interesting conscience question. At least for me, it's an interesting conscience question. On the one hand, if you're a private institution, why are you taking government money? Because if you take government money, you're not truly a private institution anymore. Government money always comes with strings. Same with your religious institution. Should you be denied? Now, should you be denied it or should you take it is two different questions. But now you basically have the courts, in this case, rightly divining by the Blaine Amendment of their state constitution that money cannot be sent, public money cannot be sent to private or religious educational institutions. Article 11, Section 4 of the South Carolina Constitution says, "No money shall be paid from public funds, nor shall the credit of the state or any of its political subdivisions be used for the direct benefit of any religious or other private educational institution." That was passed in 1972. So here we have a court directly applying the Constitution as ratified by the people of South Carolina, that public funds should not be used, public educational funds shall not be used for non-public schools. This one I think is a little interesting. First of all, I hate Blaine Amendments. They are inherently discriminatory. They are saying that the only religion that we'll allow is secularism. Any other religion we're going to treat differently. They are other. And we are not going to fund them. And these have been used in many cases truly to the damage of other organizations. And here we see another example. Now, again, personally, if I'm on the school board of a private or religious school, I don't want government money. I don't want the strings attached. But then again, that's not my call. If the parents, if they elect a school board and they want to take government money, if they want to become subjects of government, they want to be bought and paid for by government, that's their right. But we see these Blaine Amendments being used to discriminate against those with religious convictions or consciences that don't hold with whatever the current political orthodoxy is. And finally, let's take a look at a case coming out of Indiana. Now, there was a gentleman there by the name of Payne Elliott. He was fired. He worked for the Cathedral Catholic High School, and he was fired for violating his employment agreement. How did he violate that? Well, he entered into a same-sex union, which violates Catholic teaching, and part of the employment agreement was that they follow Catholic doctrine. They follow Catholic teaching. Now, he was fired, so he sued. He sued the Archdiocese of Indianapolis back in July of 2019, claiming that he was illegally fired. Now, the Archdiocese apparently got the assistance of the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty. They were representing the Archdiocese. Again, another law firm that does a lot of really good work. But I find this quote very interesting from the Beckett Fund, from their Luke Goodrich, their vice president and senior counsel. He said, quote, "If the First Amendment means anything, it means the government cannot punish the Catholic Church for asking Catholic educators to support Catholic teaching." Well, once again, we've dealt with the First Amendment question, haven't we? We're back to Congress shall make no law. Therefore, since Congress didn't make this law, it can't be a First Amendment violation. However, the Indiana Constitution, Article 1, Section 2 reads, "All people shall be secure in their natural right to worship Almighty God according to the dictates of their own conscience." And Section 3 reads, "No law shall, in any case whatever, control the free exercise and enjoyment of religious opinions or interfere with the rights of conscience." So here we have a Catholic diocese, a Catholic church, implementing Catholic doctrine in their school. We have a gentleman in the name of Payne Elliott who voluntarily agreed to abide by certain standards for his employment and then knowingly violated them. And decided that he had a right to sue, that it was wrong for a Catholic church to enforce Catholic doctrine and to enforce an employment agreement because the way he violated it was with a same-sex union. This is that elevation of certain sexual minorities over the rights of everybody else. Now, this went through the trial court, which said the lawsuit could proceed. It then went to the Indiana Supreme Court, which said, no, you need to go reconsider that decision. And finally, the Indiana Marion Superior Court threw the entire case out. So we have what ultimately I believe is the proper outcome. The Mr. Payne Elliott remains fired. My only concern is how much money has the Archdiocese and or the Beckett Fund outlaid to defend the rights of the Archdiocese? And will they have the opportunity to recoup that? Will they be able to sue Mr. Payne Elliott for damages? That's yet to be seen. But what we see here again, it's the rights of conscience. It's not simply government what they can and cannot do. It also comes down to what we the people will stand for. And when will we stand up? And I applaud, you know, I mentioned three different law firms, law groups that are defending these religious things, these people's freedom, Alliance Defending Freedom, the First Liberty, and the Beckett Fund. And if you can support these organizations, please do. Most of the ones, I've heard interviews with most of them. They do most of their work pro bono so that you don't have to pay to have your rights protected. And we need to help them as well. But it's important that we know what our rights are, that we recognize that religious freedom is so foundational. It's part of that freedom of conscience. If you can't think and act based on your conscience, your other freedoms mean nothing. It's important that we not only protect them in ourselves, that we protect them in others. And to me, the best way to do that is to educate yourself, to know what your rights are, so that not only if your rights are violated, you're prepared to defend and assert them. You're prepared to do that properly. So many of these things we're talking about, First Amendment issues that weren't First Amendment issues. They were state constitution issues. And if we understand our rights, we can help our lawyers recognize they've been taught a certain way to think by other lawyers and law professors, and we need to be able to help them. And that includes going to them and saying, you do realize that this is not an act of Congress, but you stand a much better chance. You're on much better footing if you look at the actual legal language and the violations thereof. Now, how do you do that? You know, the quote that backstops, that founds the Constitution study is one from our first Chief Justice of the United States, John Jay, who said, every member of the state ought diligently to read and study the Constitution and teach the rising generation to be free. By knowing their rights, they'll sooner perceive when they're violated and be the better prepared to defend and assert them. So that's my challenge to you. It's the challenge I took. That's how I got started in this. Someone showed me that quote. I took it as a challenge and said, I'm now going to read and study the Constitution. It is easy. You can find the Constitution free at archive.org. People hand out free constitutions all the time. There's plenty of opportunity. Here's what I want, here's what I want to offer to you. I want to offer you some other ways to help, because I know a lot of people come to me and they say, gee, Paul, I'd love to read the Constitution, but, you know, I'm busy, I don't understand the language, a lot of things. So I'll make it simple. At least I've tried to make it simple. I wrote a book called How to Read the Constitution in 30 Days. And I called it that because most people don't believe me when I say you can read the Constitution in 30 minutes. It's simple. But sometimes we need that structured help. And that's what this book does. It is a daily devotional. You open it up, you read two pages, it takes about two and a half minutes. You'll read the Constitution. There's a little highlight of something in that phrase. There's a paragraph or so of me, a little commentary I give. And in just two and a half minutes a day, in 30 days, you've read the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. You've fulfilled the first part of the John Jay Challenge. You have read the Constitution. And the nice thing is, since it's a daily devotion, you can do it over again and again and again and again. Now, you can get that book at constitutionstudy.com or at constitutionscholars.com. Just go to the store. You can get a paperback copy of the book. But if you go to constitutionstudy.com, you can request the book free. There's an icon on the right. You can either sign up for the newsletter. If you want to find out more about what the Constitution Study is doing, sign up for the newsletter. It's absolutely free, and I will give you a digital copy of that book. If you don't want to sign up for the newsletter, just click the book on the menu bar on the right, and I will send you, you'll download right immediately, a free copy of that book. So you don't even have to pay for it. I'm giving that to you. Just go to my website and ask for it. So that's the read. It's that important that I want you to do that. Now, if you want to get to the study, I wrote a book called The Constitution Study. Again, it's available both on ebook and on paperback on The Constitution Study and at constitutionscholars.com. It is a clause-by-clause study of the entire Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. Every word, every clause, fully footnoted. I give you quotes and links and everything you need to double-check what I'm saying. Now, that's available, again, on constitutionstudy.com, constitutionscholars.com. That is the second phase. That's the study. You know, read and study. And when you're done with that book, you will know more about the Constitution than just about every lawyer I have ever met. You will truly be a constitutional scholar as you're reading that book. But the third is to teach the rising generation to be free. Now, there's a lot of ways we can do that. Now, whether your children are in public school, private school, religious school, homeschooled, grown and out of the house, we can find ways to help educate them, teach them what their rights are. And if you need help, well, that's what I do here at the Constitution Study. So please head to those two websites, constitutionstudy.com, constitutionscholars.com, and find out more. And again, if you have questions on Constitution Study, just click Ask a Question. I'll do my best to answer that. And please share this program with others. My programs come out as a podcast, usually a few days after they're released. You can find more at America Out Loud. Just look for the Constitution Study under our shows. And please join me here next time on the Constitution Study.
Maybe you'll stay out of jail, love the neighbors, and have a few good friends every day.